Thanks for the invitation to speak. I really welcome the opportunity to learn from you as much as you're going to learn from me. It's always a bit interesting interaction between physicists and mathematicians because you know, a mathematician will sort of be happy to have found the beautiful structure and lots of relations between the various moving parts, and that's an end in itself, whereas a physicist is not happy until he's, you know, figured out something about the way a physical system works, and be damned if the mathematics is elegant or not. So I want to talk about the things in the title, which are scale invariant transfer matrices and Hamiltonians. They'll all be physics in basically one or maybe two dimensions. But I have to motivate it, and so that you see where I'm coming from. Otherwise, you'll all think that I'm completely crazy and the stuff is baseless. But so let me try to tell you about the ultimate goal, if you like, what I'm really trying to do, and then talk about what I've done, which, you know, is a really tiny step along the way, probably. So it has to do with subfactors and conformal field theory. And I'm going to sort of assume, this may be assuming a lot, but I'm going to assume that you all know about this side and probably know more about it than I do. Conformal field, so when I say that, there's a whole emotional and intellectual package that goes along with it, and I'm going to suppose that you're all reasonably happy with that. Subfactors, on the other hand, you've probably never heard of. So I want to say a couple of words about what they are. I don't want to go spend too much time into it, otherwise I'll never say what I want to say, but I just need to say something about them for the motivational point of view. So what are they? Well, there's the word sub means there's one that's contained in the other. So in particular, for historical reasons, they're going to be called capital N and capital M, and the small one, perversely, is going to be the N, and the big one is going to be the M. So what are they? Well, they're von Neumann algebras, which is not going to help very much, probably. Except that you surely have heard of von Neumann. And one of the things he did was, one of the things that he was interested in was the mathematical foundations of quantum mechanics and more. And in fact, he wrote the book on it in some sense. So the idea is that there's a Hilbert space somewhere for a quantum system. Hilbert space. And a von Neumann algebra M is some algebra of operators on H. Which has all of the properties that might qualify it to be the algebra of observables for a quantum system. So that's the observables. So von Neumann undertook a penetrating analysis of all the possibilities for these von Neumann algebras, and developed a theory, and it turned out that it was much, much more complicated than he or anyone else thought, and it's sort of an ongoing effort to understand the structure of all von Neumann algebras. So if you want an example, you know, what about the algebra of all operators? So that's an example, e.g. B of H, the bounded operators, all operators. Okay. So, and you know, if that's too much for you, then you can assume H is finite dimensional, in which case this just becomes the n by n matrices for some n. So that's a perfectly fine example of a von Neumann algebra, just the n by n matrices. But of course, the interesting ones from mathematical and physical point of view are mostly going to be the infinite dimensional ones. So a factor in this world of algebras is the sort of what corresponds to simple. If you we know, for instance, that groups and the algebras have the simple ones, which are supposed to be the building blocks of all of them. Well, in this von Neumann algebra world, there's the factors, and they're the building blocks of all the others. And simple is not quite right for technical mathematical reasons. If you define it to be simple as having no non-trivial ideals, you wouldn't be quite right, because there are, even in this example, if H is infinite dimensional, there are ideals in this algebra. There's the so-called compact operators. So that's not the right word. But the actual definition is even easier. It's just that the center is trivial. So one of the properties of an algebra for it to be a candidate for an algebra of observables is that it has to have an identity. And so the idea is that there's nothing in this algebra of observables that commutes with everything else except the identity. So it's some kind of physically meaningful hypothesis that there's no observables that commute with every other observable. So anyway, these are the building blocks of von Neumann algebras as shown by von Neumann. And what he discovered was that there's a lot of them. In particular, this one, which is sort of obviously a factor, is by no means the only one, and it's probably the least interesting of them. Okay, so I could tell you more and more, and then that would be the end of the lecture, because it's a very interesting and rich topic with lots of interactions. But I'm going to stop there and just say, well, I'm going to consider subfactors, right? So you know very little about factors themselves. You know even less about subfactors, except that it's just simply a factor inside another. However, you do have an example from what I've said, which you can understand and which we'll all understand immediately. And that is, we can take the complex numbers themselves. That's the the complex multiple identity, and that's contained in the, let's say, the, to be concrete, the 2x2 matrices. This is a factor, this is a trivial center. This is a factor, trivial center. So there you have an example of a subfactor. Right. So if you're processing, trying to process this talk, and this subfactor comes up and you have nothing to grasp on, well, here's something to grasp. Just the simple scalars inside the 2x2 matrices, subfactor. Obviously, that's going to be a sort of trivial example. So what I got in the picture is, well, I defined this number, which is the index of one subfactor inside another. So if you have one, there's this number, which is called the index. Okay, and once again, I'm not going to give you a complete definition of anything like that, but it's a really neat feeling writing it down. You know, you have this. It looks nice, right? It has a nice mathematical flavor to it. And obviously what it's supposed to measure is how big M is relative to N, how much bigger M is than N. So for groups, remember, for groups, if you have a subgroup of a group, then this is the relative size of G compared to H. It's the number of cosets of H that you see in G. So thinking of the cosets as being copies of the H, right? Cosets are just, so this measures the number of copies of H that you see inside G. So this measures the number of copies of N that you see inside M, right? That's what it's supposed to be. I haven't given you the technical definition. But now, just having said that, you will have no trouble giving me the answer for this, to this thing here. I did give you an example of a subfactor. The 2x2 matrices and the complex numbers. What's this index? So the talk stops here until someone gives me the answer. 4, right. I can go on. Because how many copies are there of the complex numbers in the 2x2 matrices? 4. Okay. So this index, whatever it is a number associated with a subfactor, whatever they are, that generalizes this notion of how big this one is compared to that one. Okay. So hang on to that for something to intuition to cling to. Now, as I said, the von Neumann theory is rather rich. And one of the things that came out of it, which von Neumann sort of went off into a long tangent on, is a notion of continuous dimensionality. He found that in these factors, in the new factors that are not this one, there's this dimension, idea of dimension which takes real values. So this index, although it still measures the number of copies of n inside m, you can have fractional copies. Okay, you could do this if you took, you could sort of realize this in matrices and you get rational numbers coming out of it. But, sorry, what I just said. Anyway, the point is that according to von Neumann's theory, this should be a real number. And it should be great, obviously, it's got to be greater than or equal to 1 because m is bigger than n. Okay? But from the von Neumann theory with the von Neumann definition, for this guy, it should just be some real number greater than or equal to 1. But then the first theorem that got this theory of subfactors going was the result that, in fact, Mn is belongs to the following set, 4 cosine squared pi over n, where n is 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, union the interval from 4 to infinity. So, you know, in this example, we got an integer, and that's the sort of the other side. Von Neumann says it's a real, this example says it's an integer. Well, the result is it's neither one nor the other. It's one of these funny numbers, or it's a continuously varying value, depending on which set it's in. So let me draw the set for you. This is the set of all index values for subfactors. Well, here we have this. For this number here, we know how to get, and obviously we know how to get 1. So from 4 on, we see we get everything, including infinity if you want it. But what are these other numbers? So 4 cos squared pi over 3 is 1. All right, so now I should challenge you. Also, I'm not going to go on until someone tells me what 4 cos squared pi over 4 is, since that works so well with... Come on, guys. 4 cos squared pi over 4. Go back to high school trigonometry. 4 cos squared pi over 4 is 2. Thank you. Right. All right, since we're so good at that, what about 4 cos squared pi over 6? 3. Oh, I left out 4 cos squared pi over 5. And, you know, if you went to some fancy high school, or if you... you would know that 4 cos squared pi over 5 actually is a very interesting number. It's the square of the golden ratio. 2 cosine pi over 5 is the golden ratio. So this is a number which is 2.618033 dot, dot, dot. And it's otherwise known as 3 plus root 5 over 2. And then these other ones obviously just converge up to 4. So that's, you know, that was sort of a surprising, it still is a bit surprising as the answer to the question, what are the values of this real number, the index? What can you actually get as values, these numbers? So it already has a sort of physics-y flavor, right? This is the bound states and the scattering states. Right. Right. That beautiful observation has never been led anywhere. It might be. I mean, you could figure out a Hamiltonian, I suppose. But all right. So part of the theorem, of course, was to construct examples with these numbers coming out as the index. And that was, you know, that's what I did a long time ago, and it was sort of horrible. It was an ad hoc construction that worked, and it produced all these values, but they didn't come out naturally. And so I undertook a multi-year project of trying to see where these subfactors actually arose in mathematics, and you know these particular values, 4 cosine squared pi over n, where did they come from? And the answer turned out to be, and you know, I should have taken more seriously right from the start for Neumann, because it came out you need to go basically into conformal field theory to get them. Okay, and just as a very quick word about how they occur in conformal field theory, let me tell you what has been proved that, you know, they have been proved to occur, there's certain factors. So this will give you another answer to the question, what's another example of one of these factors? So conformal field theory is, of course, supposed to be physics in a couple of dimensions, which is invariant under the group of local scale transformations. And it's supposed to split into a direct sum of tensor products of so-called chiral conformal field theories. And each chiral field theory actually lives on the circle. It only has one space-time dimension. So this is space-time for this poor little theory sitting on the circle. And so space is time and so on. And the idea is that von Neumann and his followers, so in particular Haag and Kastler, said one way to analyze these field theories should be to look at operators that are localized in certain space-time regions. And on the circle, it's an obvious choice. You can take one half of the circle, and the other half of the circle, you can look at all observables that you can get in your field theory that live inside I, and all that live inside the complement of I, which get to be called A of I and A complement, A of I complement. And if you know a bit of math, you know, the usual approaches to conformal field theory, you can take the fields of the theory and smear them by smooth functions which are supported in these intervals and get observables, fields that are localized inside these regions. Now, space is time in one dimension, so this all these operators here, by Einstein causality, commute with all these operators here. So this is right. So I'm sorry, I'm sort of piling on things. I'm almost there. The axioms of all of this von Neumann stuff and Haag-Kastler and conformal field theory, so they actually imply that these two guys are factors. These von Neumann algebras, they're factors. And they're these nice exotic factors that are not this B of H. And this one's a factor. And this one's a factor, and they commute with each other. Well, if you take the algebra, everything that commutes with a factor, it's also a factor for trivial reasons. So we get the subfactor. Immediately we get A of I contained in the, some piece of notation, A of the complement of I, commutant, and this means. So the commutant is important. It comes from physics. It's Einstein causality. It says that if you can't get from here to here in time, then the observables have to commute. So the subfactor arises because of Einstein causality. Okay, so that's how they arise. And what has been shown by Wassermann and developed by others to cover more situations is still not by no means complete, is that if you take WZW with Semino Witten, conformal field theory, and you do the chiral halves with that, then you can get subfactors, in particular, of index 4 cosine squared pi over n. By taking the gauge group SU2 and taking the level is basically given by this number here, up to n2. Okay. Look at this nice picture that given a conformal field theory, it always has a subfactor. The subfactors are interesting. And there's lots of, and all of these particular conformal field theories all work, and they give interesting subfactors. Okay, that's a nice picture. That's a whole chapter of work that has been done over the years. Okay, any questions maybe about that? Yeah.
Take just a 1D field theory and you cut it in two pieces. The boundary is pretty tricky, right?
The boundary is a subtle point in all this, and in these theories the boundary works out just fine.
Because you're smoothing.
Yeah, yeah. You can really
the union
of the two algebras is the algebra generated. You know, the algebra. If you, this is a property of these things, if you have two intervals in this one-dimensional thing, I1 and I2, then the algebra for the whole interval is the algebra, this algebra here and that one there, the algebra that they generate. That's the subtle problem, and it works. Okay, that's one of the many technical difficulties with the theory. That's a good point. So, you know, I'm just giving a very, looking at the top of a fairly huge structure which has already gone into this. Okay. And in theory, there's no reason, we don't know how to do it yet for technical reasons, but any sort of reasonably nice conformal field theory that looks a bit like this with positive, you know, where there's a real Hilbert space, should give you subfactors. Right? Now, in the meantime, the theory of subfactors has undergone a development all of its own, independent of any relations to conformal field theory or anything else, because we're mathematicians, it's there, we want, it's the mountain has to be climbed. And there's been an attempt by myself and lots of others to try to figure out what subfactors are out there. Okay, oops. Now obviously, these ones have something to do with WZW theory, with the gauge, quantum gauge field theory, but a subfactor doesn't give you a gauge field theory, but it does give you a lot of data. And I want to spend a little while saying exactly what the data is that comes out of a subfactor. Okay. So the first thing is, and once again, unfortunately, reasons of time, I don't have time even in this wonderful room to go into you know, exactly how this works, but one thing that comes out of it is a graph. And if you're interested in the connection, if you think of the connection with conformal field theory, this particular graph has a lot to do with the fusion structure of the sectors in conformal field theory. And the graph, and but it arose in completely internal way in subfactors, and it's called the principal graph. This name was given by Okneanu, and let me just say what it can be. Well, for the four cosine squared pi over n subfactors, it turns out it is the ones that will realize it are the an Dinkin diagrams. But you can also get the dn Dinkin diagrams, and you can get E6. And you can get E8. But the interesting thing is, you only get the even D's, and you only get E6 and E8, not E7. Okay. But all of these things occur as principal graphs, and the index is 4 cosine squared pi over n. So I could almost ask, this is one of these questions that I won't go on afterwards, so someone should know the yoga of Dinkin diagrams and numbers and so on. What's the 4 cos squared pi over n? What's the n from this graph? It's called the Coxeter number. Coxeter number. And I'm sure a lot of you have dealt with this before. For an, it's n plus 1. For d2n, it's 2n minus 2. For e6, it's 12. And now, what is it for e8? Someone's got to know the answer to that.
30.
Good. All right. And it's 30 for e8. So in particular, 4 cos squared pi over 30, which is somewhere out here, is realized by E8. Actually, at the risk of running out of time, but I think this is an amusing story. You'll probably like it more than the rest of the talk. So I had this theorem before I really knew the relationship of these graphs. And the prediction of the theory was that if you have a graph like this and you look at the largest eigenvalue of the graph, so you look at the, what's it called, the Laplacian on the graph, and you look at the largest eigenvalue, then that had to be 4 cosine squared pi of n for some n. Okay, so I had this theorem that had to be, but I didn't know which n, and I had no idea. I didn't know which graphs were around. So I started hunting. This was in 80-something. There were no computers around, so I had just one of these laptop, not a laptop, a adding machine, right? Things that you get in the shop. So I started feeding in graphs, and then I fed in this one, and it was supposed to be 4 cosine squared pi over n. And I tried n equals 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Oh no, my theorem's all wrong. Until finally I hit 4 cos squared pi over 30. And that was it. Because somehow I'd run into E8 before anything else. So, you know, that was when I first started to believe the theorem. So that's how these things work. Anyway, to a subfactor, there's always a graph. The graph's possible for the 4 cos squared pi over n of these ones. In general, it has something to do with diffusion structure in conformal field theory. And you experts will know at least that AN arises in SU2 WZW at a certain level. And that's all good. And so we could go ahead and take the machine of all conformal field theories, go ahead and work our butts off and construct these subfactors. This is pretty hard work, actually, doing this. And get a whole lot of subfactors of interesting index values and principal graphs and so on. That would be wonderful. Okay, and that's a project that a lot of people are working on. However, what happened once again is the subfactor theory developed on its own independently. And what happened was in the 1980s, a gentleman called Hargrup discovered the smallest subfactor of index bigger than 4. Okay, I told you there was all these. Well, these ones, let's say all these ones have to have infinite principal graph. So this goes away. So what Hargrup discovered was the smallest one bigger than 4 with finite principal graph. Okay? And now if I ask you, you know, say I won't go on unless you tell me what its index is, then I really won't go on. Because here's the answer, 5 plus root 13 over 2. So that number, which you're going to figure out is between 4 and 5, is the smallest index of a subfactor with finite principal graph whose index is bigger than 2. And let me put up I'll tell you what the principal graph is. It's a very nice looking principal graph. And if you're Hargrup or if you have a calculator handy, you can easily figure out that the norm squared of this graph is 5 plus root 13 over 2. So, you know, that was interesting. And then, of course, the question arose, well, what conformal field theory, if any, gives rise to that subfactor? Okay? And that is the jumping off point of this lecture, which is now halfway through. So what we expect from the subfactor side is that these sporadic or exotic, or whatever you want to call them, subfactors will eventually proliferate. We have it's a devil's job to construct them, but they will proliferate. And the question is there anything on the conformal field theory side corresponding to them? Okay. Well, what we know, we're almost certain that there's certainly no, not just no WZW theory, but you know, you can crank the handle. There's these coset constructions, there's orbit fold things, and you can do all kinds of things with WZW theories. You get new theories, new subfactors, and we're almost certain, well, 0.99999, that this one cannot be obtained in any way from these WZW models. So therefore, it should be a question that interests everyone here who's interested in low-dimensional physics. Is there a conformal field theory corresponding to this Hargrup subfactor? Okay.
Could you say a bit more how you get the graph from this subfactor?
I'd rather not, but since you asked the question, I have to. The simplest route to that is the theory of bimodules. And so you take M, then that contains N. So there's an action of N on the left and on the right. So M is an algebra, this is a subalgebra. So you can multiply on the left or you can multiply on the right, and that makes M tensor M into an NN bimodule, action on the left. And now what you can do is you can take, whenever you have one of these bimodules, you can take the tensor product over N of these things, where you identify the right action of n here with the left action of n here and take the quotient. And then this is, get all of these. You can iterate this process. And then you can look at it as an nn bimodule. And then you can also look at it as an n. This is going to seem a little bit odd, but this is the quickest way to do it. So this is a big nn bimodule. This is a mn bimodule. M acting on the left, N on the right. So you can decompose this, both of these, into direct sums of irreducible MN bimodules, irreducible NN bimodules. The vertices of the graph are the irreducible NN and irreducible MN bimodules. And the edges are, if you take an MN bimodule and you simply restrict the left action to N, then it becomes a direct sum of NN bimodules, and those are the edges in the principal graph. I hope that was more illuminating than confusing, but you did ask the question. I've given you what is actually a technically completely correct answer. Yeah?
In the cases of the AD Lincoln triangles, do these arise from the AD WZW theories, or is it not?
No, they arise from SU2. AN arises from SU2. DN arises from a coset construction of SU2. E6 and E8 arrive from more complicated things, but not the E6 and E8 Lie algebra things. It's a slightly different E6 and E8.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where they come into the picture. So it's really, really an SU2 level. You can get them all. Okay, so there I answered the question, but this brings me to another anecdote, actually. I remember giving a talk like this some time ago, and someone came up to me afterwards and said, "That was a fantastic talk. I absolutely loved it. I understood everything until you wrote this on the board." And then I didn't understand a word after that. So I said, "Okay, well." My next lecture, I said, well, I'm going to define this. So I said, all right, M tensor N. M is, by definition, M tensor N, okay, the ordinary tensor product. And if you don't know what that is, then there's the door. and then you quotient out by M1 N tensor M2 minus M1 tensor N M2. So that's the so-called relative tensor product over thing. Anyway, so if you do this, why you would do this with lots of philosophical reasons, but if you do this, you come up with this principal graph. And in the sort of dictionary, in this wacky dictionary between conformal field theory and subfactor theory, this graph ends up being the fusion graph for one of the sectors or something of the conformal field theory. Okay. Any more questions? All right, so I hope that I've motivated, with most of the talk gone, I've motivated what I want to do. I want to get a construction that takes a subvector, uses the data, in particular the graph, principal graph, the index, and there's more data I can tell you about, and goes from that and produces a conformal field theory, which, you know, might be a real gift to physicists as something that they won't have seen before. And that conformal field theory, of course, the corresponding subfactor is the one that we started with. And the key first question is for the Hargrove subfactor. Do that. Okay, so that Hargrove picture is in good hands. There's a fellow that probably a lot of you know called Terry Gannon. And Gannon, together with Di Evans, they've convinced themselves that there is a conformal field theory for the Hargrove. And every time I see Terry, he bursts out laughing because he knows that I'm going to ask him the question, well, where is it? Because every time he tells me, oh, I'll have it constructed by before I see you again. But it still hasn't appeared. We're all hoping that it will appear. He seems to be utterly convinced. And his reasoning is based on the modular forms that he can intrinsic to the subfactor that look like they should come from a vertex operator algebra. Okay, so, but I thought, well, you know, why sheep for a lamb? Why don't we just go for a construction that will take any subfactor and produce a conformal field theory? Okay, and that's what I want to talk about. That's where these, it's the attempt that I'm working on, and I hope to profit from things that I'll learn here from the people who do very similar stuff. But that, you know, I can't emphasize more. My point of view is somewhat different from the point of view of, say, a physicist who will have some Hamiltonian that he knows and loves and will try to find out, diagonalize it and, you know, see how it fits in, if it's critical, and so on and so forth. I'm starting with this numerical data that God, in the form of a subfactor, has given me, and I'm trying to do whatever I can with it to construct a conformal field theory. This reminds me of another story. I think full of stories there. Whatever you can. So this is actually not such a bad analogy. I've sort of slowly in my years in the U.S. and North America, I've been getting accustomed to basketball, right? And I've just been watching it. And you know, there's all these big guys and so on. But the rules just seem to be completely opaque to me. What can you do to stop these guys getting past you, or something like that? And you know, I said, well, how come this guy got away with that, and so on and so forth. And oh yeah, well, you know, there's all this technical stuff. And but then someone said to me, someone who was a real basketball fan said to me, well, look, put it this way. You can go out there in front of, I don't know who it was then, Magic Johnson or something. You can go out with one of those players. You can do whatever you like to try to stop him, and you won't succeed. So it's sort of the same with this this conformal field theory. I got this subfactor. I can do whatever I like and try to construct a conformal field theory with it. Okay. So what is the data? This is suggestive. This is suggesting my direction of travel here, because the data from a subfactor can be arranged to be what I call a planar algebra. And what does that mean? Well, I'm going to state it in the terms that were most suggestive for this crowd, hopefully. It means every time you have the circle and you have n points on the circle, okay, then there's a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Which we call P sub n. So maybe I can tell you a little bit more about it to make it a bit more concrete related to what I've said already. It's a finite dimensional Hilbert space. How big is it? Well, it's exactly as big, I can tell you what it is. On these principal graphs, they always come with a distinguished vertex, or even sort of. And the size of the dimension of this principal graph is the number of loops of length n starting at this vertex and coming back to it. That's a very concrete number that you can write down. Anyway, so you can make a basis if you want of the vector space consisting of those guys. And so that's part of the data. But the real thing is that it's a planar algebra. And what the planar algebra words mean is simply this. This connects with what people here call spin networks. It means that if I take a bunch of circles with various numbers of points on the boundary, let's make them, and I have, I meant to have those ones colored, but let me therefore make the. And then I have what you would call a spin network and what I would call a planar tangle, which is simply a way, let's put just to make it a bit more general, let's throw in what can happen. So if you know what a spin network is, then you're almost there for knowing what the meaning of this is. So that means simply that if you put an element x here and an element y here, and this x belongs to p 1, 2, 3, 4, and y belongs to p 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, then you get out an element on the corresponding to p 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. So one way that if you do spin networks, you know one way that this occurs, you can just put tensors here and contract them according to the system. So one of these is in particular, tangles does imply a spin network. The main point here is the planar point that these strings, the red lines, are never allowed to cross. Okay. So the data of a subfactor gives you the data of how to combine these vectors together to get another vector in the output. So I was thinking of these ones as being the input tensors and the other ones being the output. Okay? So this is exactly, okay, so I said the word spin networks. Well, spin networks are a special case, and it's the special case basically corresponding to that trivial subfactor scalars contained in the 2x2 matrices, or the n by n matrices. So spin networks would arise out of that subfactor. So what these AN ones and so on, they're sort of more general spin networks where the things that you put in are not just simple tensors, but in fact they're indexed by warps or loops on the principal grid. Okay. If you think about it, you can figure out ways to contract such loops, provided the network, spin network, is planar. Right. Any questions? So God, in the form of a subfactor, has given us vector spaces to points on the circle. Right.
Does this not depend on only depend on the
topology? Yeah, it only depends. Yeah, it's defined up to, it's very flexible. Yeah. And you can axiomatize that carefully, and that's all been done. But, saying, well, we're supposed to be constructing conformal field theories, it's hard to resist the temptation, maybe even should be resisting, I don't know, but to say, well, let's have a shot at just making the Hilbert space as some kind of limit Hilbert space with a number of points on the boundary of the circle, like this thing here, tends to infinity. So we're hoping to, so here's the hope, prayer, call it what you like, realize Hilbert space of CFT as we call it P infinity. Infinitely many points. The whole circle is a boundary. And then, we're supposed to get these algebras of operators and Virasoro algebra and everything. All of this is supposed to end up acting on P infinity. Supposed to be the chiral half, by the way. Chiral. Okay? You can say that's a lousy idea, you can say it's a great idea, I don't know, but it's certainly very tempting and it's worth having a shot. Yeah, so we're going to have a shot and see what comes out in the next 15 minutes. All right, so the devil, of course, is in what do you mean by P infinity? How do you take this infinite limit, right? I mean, this is, in this quantum spin change, this means how do you take the limit, the infinite tensor product of vector spaces. Well, that's a subtle, as any physicist knows, that's a subtle problem. You've got to have some kind of ground state and excitations and so on if you want to do it properly. But we have some guides, hopefully, and the guides are, well, let's take what the subfactor gives us. And what the subfactor gives us is lots of canonical elements inside Pn. This gives you a lot of structure. I mean, it's hard to see it when you just see a picture drawn like that to imagine that there's a lot of structure. There's a huge, vast amount of structure on each of the PNs and interconnecting all of the PNs, and that's been heavily studied. And if we're to get PN in any sensible way, then we've got to be able to go from PN to PN plus 1 or Pn to P2n or something like that. And the first thing that I've tried on which this is all based is to double the number of spins. So I'm thinking really of these points on the boundary as being spin sites. And I want to take something in Pn and get something in P2n coming out of it And I'm going to get it simply by choosing. Sorry, according to this, these should be red lines, right? So this thing is a planar tangle where I'm sort of implicitly assuming that I've got an element which I'll call R, which I'm putting in all of these guys here. And since I'm going to be using the same R all the time, I can just suppress it and replace R by this. So that's given me a way of embedding Pn, this vector space, Hilbert space, inside this one. It'll be a Hilbert space embedding exactly if we have this condition. This is equal to this. Actually, you need a star here to make it correct. All right, so the question is, firstly, well, what do I choose for R? Okay, well, horrible question, except that I did say that there are, these subvectors sometimes have canonical elements in them. And there is a subvector, in fact, there's a whole family of them, for which there's only one choice of R, okay? Up to a scalar, and that scalar can, you can basically get rid of it by that normalization condition. So there are subvectors in which there's a unique R. Well, that solves the problem, doesn't it? We'll just look at those ones and use that R and see what comes out. Okay, so one of those subvectors is, well, it's not quite, but it's 4 cos squared pi over n minus 1 squared. Has that index that will give you examples where there's a unique R. Okay, so we're going to work in that one. No choice about what R is, but so therefore, you know, P infinity is now quite clear. We just take Pn and contain them. So we've got Pn and P2n. And by iterating this process, we get P4n and P2 to the kn. So go all the way, take the union of all of these, and we're going to call that the P infinity. That's our first shot. And for various reasons which have to do with Guiffre and Tobias Osborne, we're going to call that the semi-continuous limit. If we were calling it the continuous limit, that would mean that we're done, right? But it's not. That's the word semi there is to indicate that this really has some serious deficiencies. So what are the deficiencies? Well, this sort of tree-like structure for embedding, basically we can, from now on, forget about the circle and just pretend we're working on the interval. Then we have used this kind of structure to embed each of these Pn's, this would be P1, P2, P4, and so on, each one into the next one. And there's something horribly non-physical about that, in that if you take two sites, two spin sites at the end here, they can be, you know, one can be over here and one can be over here, so very distant on the lattice, but extremely close on the tree, just a couple of steps up and down, and you're miles away from where you started, exponentially. So that's not good. That's one bad thing, and I should say that dual to this picture, this is sort of dual or adjoint to the sort of block spin renormalization, where you'd be going in the reverse direction, going from P2n to P2n minus 1, and so on. P2n to Pn, and so on. And this particular structure has been tried by people doing renormalization, block spin renormalization. It's been tried and found wanting. Okay? Well, let me not say much more about it, but there's people in this room who have discovered an object which they call a mirror, which does a better job. In fact, possibly does the job. But they have a very different point of view. In particular, they're given something which we haven't even talked about yet, which is a Hamiltonian, right? There's nothing physics, there's no dynamics going on yet in this picture. All I've constructed is this infinite dimensional Hilbert space on which I'm now supposed to draw my pictures and which I'm supposed to make things happen. So so if we're going to get anywhere, the next thing we've got to do is to produce Hamiltonians. Now, even though this tree structure has been found wanting, I want to continue with it and analyze it as far as possible to see exactly what goes wrong with it, in the hope that if I find out exactly what goes wrong with it, right at the last point, I can just tweak and say, but this, if you do this, it works. And maybe at the end of the day, if you introduce the disentanglers, then that will work, but we'll see. The other reason, of course, is that there's something I'm not telling you about, which is that this theory led to very interesting representations of what's called Thompson's group, which is quite popular these days in mathematics. And you can get them from this tree structure, and they have to do with knots and topological quantum field theories and things like that. So, but I'm not going to go into that, but it's certainly a reason not to completely abandon yet the tree structure. All right, so an attempt, I have to be quick now with the Hamiltonians. In an attempt to get them, I'm going to return to the theory of transfer matrices and in the quantum inverse scattering method as proposed a long time ago by Fadeev et al. And you start with a transfer matrix, which is made up of a whole lot of spins here and the so-called spectral parameter lambda, and you impose cyclic horizontal boundary conditions, and this gives you an operator that's supposed to, in the statistical mechanics world, it will go from one row of lattice spins to the next one in classical statistical mechanics. But you can also think of it as being an operator on a quantum spin chain where the spins are sitting here, and this operates from these spins back to themselves. Okay. So the idea is that if you take the logarithmic derivative of t at zero, then what you find is by the product rule for differentiation, that this ends up being a sum of I of, you put in, this is basically t prime, this is some kind of, the derivative at zero of this local guy, and sum of I and I plus 1. So the transfer matrix, when you differentiate it, gives you this local Hamiltonian. This is the nearest neighbor interaction Hamiltonian on the quantum spin chain. And if all of these commute with each other, they will commute with t prime at 0. They will commute with the Hamiltonian. So you come up not just with a Hamiltonian, but one which has a large family of commuting matrices, which so you can have some hope to diagonalize it. So I want to do the same with my tree structure. So this is all still very naive, and we won't really get much beyond that naive picture, but I want to show you how the picture is going. And just point out a few little mathematical miracles that occur along the way. All right, so how might we get a transfer matrix that interacts well with this tree structure? Well, we could say, let's suppose that it's an operator for each scale, so for each n, for each number of spins, and then twice that number of spins, which is strictly scale invariant. In other words, if I take a state of this spin chain, double the number of spins, if I apply that transfer matrix here, I get the same thing. If I apply the transfer matrix up here, maybe with some slightly different parameters. So what does that equation look like in diagrams? And these diagrams work in a planar algebra or as tensor networks, as you like. The equation will be this, however you want to interpret it. And that is obviously guaranteed by the following local equation, that this is equal to this. Okay, so I'm asking you, since we only have seconds to go, to just use your imagination and as to what the mathematics going on here. So at the end of the day, we want to solve this equation. And once we've got a solution, we can get a scale invariant transfer matrix. All right, now I've got to put in some numbers here. I had the spectral parameter. Turns out that I have to throw away the idea of the same spectral parameter at each lattice site. So I have to envision A's and B's and C's. Okay, so I'll use A and B at this scale, and at the one coarser scale, I'm going to use C. And it's the choice of A's, B's, and C's will depend exactly where I am on the lattice side. All right, so this is just an equation in tensors, if you like, in the planar algebra, if you like, in the subfactor, if you like, and then go ahead and solve it. And I solved it completely in this particular example, this particular subfactor here. I solved it, and the answer was quite intriguing. The answer was that there exists a one-parameter family exactly one-parameter family, A lambda, B lambda, and C lambda. Satisfying this equation, which I call the ABC equation, because it's got A, B, and C. All right, so I can construct literally scale invariant transfer matrices, provided I use this unique solution A, B, and C. And then there's two mathematical miracles, and then I guess I better stop there without ever getting to the Hamiltonians. Two mathematical miracles occur. The first is, and you might have been sort of suspecting this all along, just waiting for the words, that these satisfy the Yang-Baxter equation. Yang-Baxter. That is to say, if we have A and B, there is a third one, which is not C. Okay, you all know what the Yang-Baxter equation is. If you don't, it's not going to help you do it. Okay, that all of these fit into a Yang-Baxter equation in a kind of non-obvious way, in that the Yang-Baxter equation involves an A and B and a third one, but it's not this third one, some other third one. A, it's true in this model, and B, I have no way of proving it except by doing detailed calculations in the model. So for me, it remains a total miracle. And the second miracle, and I'll stop, is that when we use this, because A is not equal to B in these solutions, the transfer matrix is not going to be spatially homogeneous. We're going to have to use different lambdas, different values of lambda at each site, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and so on. In a kind of crazy pattern that reflects the tree structure, right? Which one you use, it depends on where this is sitting on the tree, how far we go down to on the tree. But there's still only one parameter, lambda, because all these lambda 1, lambda 2 are all functions of this given parameter. And the amazing thing is that if you use these ones, then you still have commuting transfer matrices. Even though you're doing the spatially non-homogeneous thing, if you just take one of these solvable models where the transfer matrices commute, and then you use different ones, if you just use any old different ones, they won't commute. But the structure of this with this tree is such that if you use those particular choice of lambdas, they still commute. So you have what looks awfully like a solvable, non-spatially homogeneous, completely scale invariant model. And time has run out, so I have to stop. Yeah. Thanks for listening.
To associate spectral parameter also to the vertical lines. And then this kind of R matrix you get is like a difference between the horizontal spectral parameter and the vertical spectral parameter. So it seems like it's a bit related.
Yeah, you could put the spectral parameter on the lines if you wanted.
Is it related?
Well, yeah, actually, I didn't say this, but not only do you get a solution of the Yang-Baxter equation, it is the Isergen-Korepin solution of the Yang-Baxter equation, which was known in the 1980s.
Six-vertex model?
Not quite six-vertex model. It's a nine-vertex model or something. Okay. It's in three-dimensional space. So the number of spin states per site is 3. But it's an old model. It's interesting that there's two different models that share the same underlying mathematical structures. Zurgen-Kraepin and another one. And this picks out the Zurgen-Kraepin and throws away the other one. Kind of interesting.
Is this model attached to a concrete R? You mentioned first
An R, right.
Did you not mention which R you were using here?
I didn't, because it's unique, right? I said that I'm...
So it's an example where it's unique.
Example where it's unique. And if you want to actually get it, and you're a spin chain fanatic, a tensor network fanatic, then you can get it by taking the spin tensor spin networks, which are 3 spin sites per... So the underlying spins are 3 spin states. But you don't use all tensors. You only take the ones that are invariant under the global gauge group SO3, acting on C3. And because if you take two, you know, elementary quantum mechanics, if you take two spin 1 particles and put them together, you get spin 0 plus spin 1 plus spin 2. And the R is the thing that hits that copy of the spin 1 in the tensor of 2 spin 1s. And that's the R that comes out. And the simplest, that's when n is infinity, so it's for index 9, simply, in this case. So I think there's, yeah.
So stepping back towards the beginning of the talk, why are you focusing on two-dimensional CFTs only? Wouldn't you think that some of these numbers, some of these indices would come from, I don't know, six-dimensional CFTs or other things?
Yeah, so here I'm in a bit, still starting to get a little bit out of my depth, because I'm hearing a lot of people are telling me, including Witten, that you can get these things from four-dimensional theories. This work by Costello or someone is here. Oh, Kevin Costello. You shake your hand. Terrific. That somehow you can get these two-dimensional theories. Well, some, you know, the real experts here. So I'm not sure. From the point of view which I grew up in, the hard-cast layer point of view, then that's not going to happen, because in higher dimensions, if you just take these algebras of operators associated to space-time regions, then if you're in high enough dimensions, you can go this way or that way, and it doesn't make any difference. And the reason that you're getting these interesting values is simply because in low dimensions it makes a difference whether you rotate that way or whether you rotate that way. So I'd like to, at some point I'd like to hear how we get these things from something higher dimensional. But obviously it can't be in quite such a simple way. I mean, I'm extremely encouraged by this, but in the hope that maybe these theories actually are useful in four dimensions where we're supposed to live and move and have our being, right? So Kevin, I think you had a question.
Oh, yes. So are these the models? And you mentioned the OR matrix. Are these the ones associated with the Young Impress of 3 or something?
Yes.
Simple?
Yeah, it's that simple. And it's only the Yangian for exactly for index 9. For these other ones, it's not the Yangian. It's the R matrix with the not elliptic but trigonometric R matrix.
That's
your spin. It's that simple. Yeah. Well, that's because I just took this very simple planar algebra, this very simple subvector.
But like, so I have a second question. So when people normally take continuum limits of these spin chains, they find non-conformal field theories.
Right. Well, yeah, I would be perfectly happy if it was a non-conformal field theory, as long as I get my subfector. I'm not married to the conformal thing. But one suspects that just all we know how to do, things that we know how to produce, when we start with the WZW or something and produce the theory, and that's a conformal theory. But no, if it turns out that I can do it with a non-conformal field theory, then that would be fine. In fact, you know, by using this tree, I can actually get a toy kind of model with algebras associated to regions, and it works, but it's horribly discontinuous. So I don't get the factors that I want. So, you know, obviously this problem of which R to use is a serious issue. I mean, maybe I should say that there's an alternative approach, which for some reason I haven't used so much, which is to my colleagues in operator algebra are much happier because you use, and when you take the thermodynamic limit of a spin chain, you're just adding more and more instead of the scaling limit, then it's much easier to say what the Hilbert space is. You just take the operators and you keep tensoring algebras of, say, 2x2 matrices, and then you look for a KMS state on that, and then you construct the Hilbert space from the KMS state. So one way to do this would be, instead of taking directly on the Hilbert space, embed the algebras on the spin chain, one in another, which you can do using some other subfactor structure in a quite canonical way, then look for KMS states on that. That might be a much better way for me to proceed, but I'm just very seduced by this way, especially because there's been the spin-off and the proximity of the mirror. So I hope to get somewhere.
Question or comment? If not, let's invite again.